without further ado, what I'd like to do is introduce Professor Margaret Ledwith, who's going to give our keynote. I'm absolutely thrilled and delighted that Margaret agreed to come up for this study day, because I know that plenty of you whose faces I know around here know Margaret's work and know her the books that she's written. Margaret lives in Lancaster, where she's Emeritus Professor of Community Development and Social Justice at the University of Cumbria. She worked with communities in Scotland and Northwest England for many years before moving into youth and community development education. And you may be interested to know that she has strong links with Montrose and has worked in Montrose, which is of interest to me because I live there. Margaret's written many books, and I think the one that I know best is The Community Development: A Critical Approach, which was awarded best-selling title of all time by Policy Press in 2009. And Margaret was given a Lifetime Achievement Award. And Margaret is currently involved in writing a further book, building on the relevance of her work to practitioners in health, housing, teaching, social work, as well as youth and community work. So I know you'll be interested to hear about that from Margaret. And finally, the last thing I need to say is that Margaret is on the coordinating committee of CARN. And CARN is the most wonderful network of people interested in collaborative action and research. There are people I can see around me who are involved in CARN. And it's an opportunity to get together with people who have like-minded interests in participatory research, collaborative research, and making a difference. So I hope that you'll get to know more about CARN today, and I hope you'll enjoy yourselves very much. Thank you.
Well, I'm avoiding the spotlights here. I've got to just jump across all the room there. How lovely it is to be here. It's such a pleasure, and even more so to see so many people gathered into what I would call a critical space. You know, we don't have much opportunity for those these days, do we? Getting together and talking about the things that really matter and sharpening our practice as a consequence. So I hope that's the spirit that we're going to enter into today, because let's face it, we're in some dire times that need us to be sharp and critical. So I don't need to say anything more about CARN. Karen's introduced CARN, other than to say how we spread our work beyond the local is a massive challenge to us, isn't it? We have enough to do at local level, but unless we move out collectively, we don't get that collective action that moves, that aspires towards the transformative. And joining networks like CARN that have a global reach is one way we reach not only our nations, but across nations as well. So I'm here today. I hope Karen's going to be delighted at the end of it. She says delighted at the beginning. What was it? Something and delighted.
Thrilled.
Thrilled and delighted. I hope that's how she's going to feel at the end of what I've got to say. So what I'm aiming for here is to give you food for thought, but even to get you excited, which would be even better. So here we are. Who am I? I say this because there's a lot I could talk to you about here that weave the ideas, because who I am is where the ideas have come from. It holds the experience that have shaped my ideas. And I think with any ideas, it's important to know the context that's produced the person that has the ideas. So this isn't sort of self-aggrandizement. It's about, you know, what authority have I got to stand here talking to a room full of you? Well, because I was a practitioner out there and did it, and that's where the ideas have come from, is the only authority I have to talk about them. So let's have a quick whip through what I mean by that, because each one of these points holds a story, and Karen's going to attack me if I go down the route of stories and we take till lunchtime to finish what I've got to say. So I can see her out of the corner of my eye here, and she might start brandishing something at me. Many, many years ago, I found myself in a classroom as a newly qualified teacher with 32 children looking at me and my knees knocking together in fear. But what happened in that room, and what I wasn't equipped for after 3 years of training to be a teacher, was the fact that classrooms are microcosms of power. I knew something was wrong. Do you know what I mean? But I hadn't been equipped with the ideas to make sense of power getting acted out in that classroom. I remember Jeff The kids loved Jeff because he was a laugh a minute. I used to conduct the school choir with Jeff, and if he hit a wrong note on the piano, he'd stand up, open the lid, tweak it around, put it down, and give his thumbs up and start playing again, and the kids loved that sort of humour. But in the staff room, Jeff used to say at the beginning of every term, rub his hands together. That sorted those little somethings out. There are a couple who will make it in life, a few in the middle, and then the rest of them. And I just felt this was appalling, that 9 and 10 year old children had people making judgments about who they were. So I went on a mission to understand how, I realise now, it's how power works in society. I didn't know what it was about, and if we don't know what it's about, we are likely to fall into traps. And I think I fell into the trap of thinking that educational failure, rather than what I prefer to call education failing people, held the key. So I went into adult literacy, and I worked with people like Joan, who kept her arm, you know, at the age of 50-something, kept her arm around a piece of paper, writing away, hoping that if she wrote enough, she'd learn to read and write. And so the pain of hearing the stories that she had made sure she forgot her glasses, all sorts of excuses for times when she might be asked to read something or sign a form or whatever else. Stories of failure that ruins lives. And what the point of somebody at the door? No, the wind at the door. The point I'm trying to make here is that we can pathologize people so very easily if we haven't got an analysis of power to understand what is creating local lives. So moving on, I had a life-changing experience in Montrose where I was so lucky to be invited to be part of a Home Office reception centre for Vietnamese refugees. You remember people termed the boat people in those days. And they politicised me. They taught me about power, and I saw life differently from then on. So after that, in my seeking out theories of power, I was offered educational psychology at Edinburgh University and community learning and development. And it was the Vietnamese people who changed my life, and I went into community learning and development there and was introduced to theories of power, such as Gramsci's concept of hegemony. And I listened to this, and it was so obvious and so simple. I thought, hey, why did I not think of this myself? And that's an important point, because we tend not to be able to force our way through the dominant hegemony that is what we're immersed in to see life differently. When I was introduced to a notion that power reaches down into civil society through the state, and as well as forcing us to behave in certain ways, persuades us to behave in those ways, because control is so much easier, isn't it, if you're persuaded that that's a common sense point of view. It made such obvious sense that it changed my life. So I had my life completely changed in Montrose and in Edinburgh, and saw life differently. And again, in Nicaragua, I'd love to tell you stories about how, for instance, I met the general of the army in the Northern Territory, who told us all about what they were doing to preserve participatory democracy when the US of A was setting off sonic booms, training people in terrorist methods to undermine this tiny little country, which posed such a major threat to what was what and what is the USA. And he talked about this, and then he turned to our little group and he said, right, I've talked enough about us. We've sent money to your miners, you know, the 1984 five miners strike. I'd like to hear how you've used that opportunity to deepen your democracy in the UK. What do you say? Do you remember the days when the BBC was taken over and footage was given that made the miners look as if they were on the attack and undermining the status quo, and all that went on there? And that was another moment, you know, these moments that get you thinking very clearly, because the miners were demonised. So lots of things I could tell you about life-changing moments that I've had along the way, and that's just a very brief lightning trip through some of them. But there was a moment when I started working in Hattersley, a very large, what was originally called a Manchester slum clearance estate rather than community or town. I thought, how do I stay critical? You know, after all of this thought, how do I retain a praxis, a unity of theory and practice, so that I don't fall into the trap of not thinking when I'm out in community? So I decided to enrol for a PhD at Manchester University. And I found that what was expected of me as a researcher was to take people's lives and to decontextualise them. And that's another theme I want to cover in this talk. You cannot understand what's happening in people's lives if you study them outside their political context. And so I found that all these ways of measuring people's behaviour, where you take them away and look at behaviour, was profoundly uncomfortable. So the point I make here is a moment where Paul Jones, my colleague, handed me Reason and Rowan's Human Inquiry. And I looked at it. It's based on, I don't know whether you've ever seen it, it was published in the early 80s. It was a social movement for change in how we research people's lives. It was about action research, and it was a group of people coming together from all over the place to produce a book that embedded these ideas into something that was transformational. Now, in the front of this cover, I read, "This book's about human inquiry, about people exploring and making sense of human action and experience. Ways of going about research which offer alternatives to orthodox approaches. Alternatives which do justice to the humanness of all those involved in the research endeavour." And at that point, my eyes lit up. And ever since then, I've been a strong advocate of action research, which has not always been accepted readily into the universities, but now I think we're at a stage where it stands alongside everything else. And this was a revolutionary point. This book, the product of action for change on the part of participatory action researchers, and that too changed the way I saw research then as a living praxis. Do you see the point I'm making? We've got theory on one side, we've got practice. Participatory action research offers us the glue that binds those two together as a form of praxis. So, right, let's move on. I'm only now talking about our main themes, so hold on to your seats because I'm going to accelerate. I'm going to talk today about health and well-being, but in relation to social inequalities, because I don't think you can understand it without understanding what's going on politically. I'm going to talk about neoliberalism as a politics of disposability. More about that in a minute. I'm going to talk about theorising the global economic, social, cultural contradictions that we live by in our everyday existence, manifest at a local level. And I'm going to talk about privilege, not poverty, as the problem. And then I'm going to, at the end of it, talk more about PAR as a critical living praxis. So the first point to emphasise is that participatory action research must be contextualised in its political times if it is to aspire to anything transformative. And by that, I mean about change for a more fair and just world in which human compassion rather than profit is the imperative that drives us. So let's have a quick look at whatever is going on. If transformative practice needs to be politically contextualised. We need to understand the forces at play. So whatever is going on, since the 1980s, when we saw the rise of neoliberal globalisation, what's important to understand here, you know, before that, it would have been laughed off the stage. The notion that the market could govern people would have been laughed out of existence, but it found a niche in those times, and it suddenly escalated. I mean, in the UK through Thatcherism, but all over the place with other people driving it. So we've now seen this system that calls itself free trade, seeking profit by exploiting people and planet as a way of seeing the world, a worldview sold to us as making sense. But when we look at the consequences, if we track those at the same time, we've seen a more divided world. We've seen global crises of social justice and environmental justice and escalating inequalities. But think about the strange phenomenon of social divisions in rich countries. Now, what might I mean by that? If we loosely take the fact that by the time Thatcherism had finished with us, one in every three children in the UK was growing up in poverty, but at the very start of Thatcherism, it was only one in ten, we see a parallel growth in inequalities that suggest that as in the UK, we're the seventh richest country in the world, and yet we've got one in three of our children overall growing up in poverty. So the point I'm making there is that poverty is not an inevitability, it's a choice, and these patterns are being repeated everywhere, that there's no need for poverty, we're making the choice. And as we go on, this global contempt for the poor is something I want you to hold in mind. Because what is it in our heads that justifies that our children should grow up with the hopelessness of poverty? Okay, let's take a look at that. I suspect I'm needing to go faster, aren't I?
You're doing
fine. Yeah, okay, here we go. Here, take a look at that for a moment and reflect. Who's this? What's going on there? Where do you think it is? What's happening? And who's it happening to? But importantly, why is it happening? So, at that point, I'll briefly tell you about the story of a young man just like this that I happened to see on a TV documentary. And it was during Hurricane Katrina, when New Orleans, because of the poor maintenance of the levees, got flooded out. And I saw a young man just like him who was so distressed, because you may remember that everybody who could get out of New Orleans and had the power and the resources to get out, got out. You may remember that Bush took no notice until he was shamed on the world stage for not acting. You may remember the bloated, dead bodies of mostly young or old or mothers, mostly black people, floating on the floodwaters of New Orleans with nobody doing anything to save people. And this young man was heartbroken that the people were just abandoned, his people were just abandoned. And he went past one of those, those yards where they stack up those yellow school buses, and he thought, I can do something here. And he nipped over the fence and he hotwired a bus. And I just thought, in that moment,
What ingenuity, what an amazing act of bravery. And he spent days ferrying older people, mothers with young children, back to that dome place, back and forth, doing everything he could. And I thought in my mind, wow, that, you know, is just so impressive. What do we do to acknowledge something like that as an act of courage? You know, what do you give, you know, a medal of outstanding bravery? And a moment or two later, I heard what happened to him, that he got banged up for stealing a bus. And I started thinking, would this have happened in the same way had it been different people somewhere else? Would it have been an immediate national emergency? You know, why is it that that's happened to him? But the point I'm making is that unless we critique what's going on around us, we don't actually get it. And so Henry Giroux, who you may or may not know, he's an American critical pedagogue, and he writes really powerful stuff. And he said, we have failed, all of us working for social justice, have failed because we didn't critique Hurricane Katrina. And his comment at the time was that if we had critiqued this, we would be able to see neoliberalism in action, with its emphasis on the centrality, the importance of producers and consumers. So in other words, if profit is the main imperative, if you consume or produce, you're central players in that game of profit. And he's suggesting that we witnessed a politics of disposability in which there is a world coming upon us where the poor, you know, I'm going to have one of Kirsty's throat sweets. Hold on. Hold on to the poor. I know where I got to. I can feel my voice starting to crack a bit. A world in which the poor, the black, the female, the young, the old, the sick, disabled, are disposable players in this game of profit. So the point I'm making here is to emphasise that if we fail to be critical, we're just overlooking the contradictions that we live by, where inhuman acts are being sold as common sense. That is what I've set as some of the issues we're facing in our practice, as the context we're working in. The next thing I'm going to do is to look at some of the challenges in our practice that this suggests. I think any of us that say we're in a practice that aspires to social justice are accountable. If we can't actually say how what we do is contributing to social change for greater justice, I think that we have to question whether we can claim to be practicing social justice. Bit heavy, but I think it's time to stand up and be counted. We have a major problem because there is an eternal theory practice divide. And what we do is we fail to develop praxis, and what we're doing if we do that is operating on a level of thoughtless action. We are not able to actually plan and conduct our work by saying why we're doing it in a certain sort of way and how it leads to change that is for a better future. We don't move towards collective action. We stay local. We often stay personal. These are critiques that have come our way in practices that from within what we do, not people outside, and we have to look at what they say to us. What about the whole stuff about radical concepts? I remember the day that I saw social justice embedded in policies that turn social justice into improving service delivery. What a load of nonsense, because how can you achieve social justice by simply improving service delivery? I'm suggesting to you that that is placatory. By that, I mean we're patting people on the head, making life a little bit better around the edges, but not changing anything at all that's creating the disadvantage and injustices we're dealing with. I think we've fallen into a trap for all sorts of reasons that are justifiable. We've had to chase funding, we've had all sorts of managerial pressures put on us. But I think instead of influencing policy, we've allowed ourselves a lot of the time to become deliverers of top-down policy. And think what that means. We are delivering policies that actually work often against what we are claiming to be about. How about this point? That we're becoming so cynical that it often translates into complicity with the power we condemn. I see one or two nods around the room. You know, we forget what we're about. You know, we become cynical. We deliver policies that work against what we stand for. And who are we then when we look at that? And overall, that results in a loss of clarity of purpose. So let's see if we can get critical today and start to look more thoroughly at what we see, the contradictions around us. Right. Just take a moment to reflect. Dialogue and reflection, so central to critical practice. Have a moment to think about that. I'd love to do with you is to have time to dialogue, because when we start to talk together about some of these ideas, we apply them to our own practice much more. So it would be lovely to have enough time to do that, and I think that's an important stage of exploring the relevance of some of these ideas. But just in case you didn't recognize that section, I was looking at some of the issues we're facing. I'm moving on to look at some of the evidence in front of our eyes now. This is a lovely statement, isn't it? This was in the front of the UNICEF report 2007 on childhood well-being in rich industrialised countries. So the true measure of a nation's standing is how well it attends to its children. Of course, you know, it makes absolute sense, doesn't it? Look at what it's saying: their health and safety, their material security, their education and socialisation, their sense of being loved, valued and included in their families and in society. Just take that on board, because that is a beautiful statement. And when we talk about well-being, these are the sorts of things we're talking about. At the same time, in that report in 2007, the UK came bottom of 21 countries, 21st out of 21 in measures of childhood well-being. That's disgraceful, isn't it? Absolutely disgraceful. I've shoved Norway there because Norway came seventh. And I'm doing this because we're told a lot of the time nothing we do can make a difference, and that makes us give up. In some countries, they're making a difference because they don't think the same. And what I'm suggesting to you is the problem is the way we think. If we can think differently, we become critical and our practice changes, and together we can all make a difference. Let's have a quick sit through the evidence. I've mentioned to you that in the period of the rise of neoliberalism through Thatcher, child poverty went through the roof. It didn't just go through the roof on its own, though. You know what I've just said about ideas? We heard, sorry, pillars. I'm trying to move around so that you don't get completely blocked by pillars. The dominant ideology of the welfare scrounger, the undeserving poor, took hold so hard. No such thing as society. The rise of individualism, we saw a different sort of thinking come about. The Child Poverty Act. Oh no, let me tell you about Killeen first of all, because I think that's important. I've slipped him in here. In 2008, somebody called Killeen, published through Joseph Rowntree Foundation, levelled the question, is UK poverty a violation of human rights? And I thought that was really important. He accused successive governments of failing to change the attitudes of the country as a whole away from this welfare scrounger stuff. So, more like the Norwegians have, that everybody has a right to be supported and included in society. And as a whole, we need to be committed to a common good so that everybody feels valued and able to give of their potential. But he said, there's a new thing going on here now, which he called povertyism. And I don't think povertyism sits alongside all the other disadvantages. I think it's embracing racism, sexism, all of the other areas of social disadvantage that get targeted, and people are getting lumped as social detritus at the bottom of society in this massive hatred of the poor. And that's a theme I'm going to carry on developing in a moment. What else did I want to say to you here? Oh, Child Poverty Act was wonderful. Child Poverty Action Group got overexcited about working with a government that wanted to end child poverty. The reality is, in Scotland alone, 21% of children are growing up in poverty now. By 2020, instead of ending child poverty, 100,000 more Scottish children will be in poverty, and over the UK as a whole, there'll be another 800,000 in poverty. So we are violating what's embedded in law. You see what I mean? In law, we have committed to ending child poverty. Do you know, living contradictions, aren't they? Just absolutely outrageous. If you doubt what I'm saying, I've just thrown this in. The point that I'm making is that that great double act called epistemology and ontology, which just means simply the way we see the world affects the way we behave in the world. And if you doubt it, just look at the recent stuff we've had on disability benefit. The attitudes that if you've got people in government saying there are welfare scroungers on disability benefit, what's happened? Most disabled people are being attacked, spat at, reviled in the streets. The message is so powerful. I could go on there, but I think I'm going to move on because I'm so frightened of Karen coming up behind me.
I'm terrified.
Shout, she's behind you. Warn me in time. Okay, just quickly, who's at risk? Not everybody's at risk of poverty. Children growing up in lone parent families, unemployed, low paid, families affected by disability, ethnic minority families, but the greatest at risk group of poverty are children. We're looking at health and well-being. We've known for years, for decades, that if you're in poverty, you have lower levels of mental health, mental well-being, emotional well-being. Poverty kills. You have to say it as it is. Do you know that if you're growing up in poverty in Scotland, you're likely to die on average 11 years younger than people not growing up in poverty? So poverty does kill. It also makes you more ill through the lifespan. It also results in particularly our young men killing themselves in the age group 16 to 24. Massive suicide rates. Or if you take those as, oh, how sad, there's been a personal death. It isn't a personal death, it's a political death. You see what I'm getting at? I know in community, you know, people will be very sad if an individual kills themselves. But if you look at how many people it's happening to, it becomes political. That's what I'm trying to say. If we see it as personal, we miss the point. It creates hopelessness. But more than that, it creates a very unhappy society. Nobody's a winner. everybody in society loses. So at that point, just have a moment again to think about, how do you see poverty affecting people's lives in your own practice? What's it doing to people? Ideas into a stage of analysis. I was looking at the evidence, and the evidence is harsh. But we're not doing enough to change what's going on. So let's move into a stage of analysis. So the point I'm making here is that a lack of theory and practice results in thoughtless action. See what I mean? Thoughtless action, an actionless thought, are no good to anybody. We're looking for theory in action, a critical living praxis. We're developing, we're taking ideas. Ideas don't just come out of nowhere. Of course we work with ideas, but we develop them in action. We look for evidence, we build on the theories. If we're thoughtless, practice becomes at best placatory. You remember what I said? It's condescending, it's patting people on the head, making life a bit better. I'm not saying it shouldn't be a bit better, but it works alongside more critical action for change. We can't talk about practicing empowerment if we don't have analyses of power. Because empowerment needs to be understood in relation to disempowerment. So we need to have that thinking there. So I've talked to you a little bit about the traditional eclectic range of theories that those of us who aspire to social justice use. And some of those traditionally have been based on Paulo Freire, Gramsci, feminism, anti-racism. But these alone are no longer enough to cope with what's going on. What I've been talking about. We need something that gets to the heart of the matter. We need to understand how so many people in our society can be dehumanised, be reduced to being seen to have cheap, disposable lives. So what I thought I'd do, that's a lot of words on one slide, isn't it? Sorry about that. I must have felt that all of these words are very important, so I do apologise, but I want to introduce Imogen Tyler because she's affected my thinking a lot recently. She's taken social abjection theory and she's applied it to people in community for us to develop as a work in progress in relation to our practice. So, just hold on a moment, I can't turn the page with that in my hand. So where I want to start off is she's offering this to us to think about as a theory of power, but more than that, to help us understand subjugation, how people are put down, and resistance. So it's more than just a theory of power. It's like Paulo Freire's critical pedagogy. It helps us to see how to work with it, to act with it. And in doing this, she takes neoliberalism beyond something that's just called free market to understand it as a form of social control. And in this social control, state power is constantly producing a dialectical relationship. And by that, I just mean subject, object. In other words, she says, privilege can't maintain itself without this layer that is relegated as social abjects. It needs that to define itself. Am I being clear here? The relationship of privilege can only exist in relation to disadvantage. So it's become, she suggests, a relationship of power and disgust. So it's essential to have, to maintain that power, to have this object of derision as an unworthy form of human detritus, in other words, the waste of society. In doing this, it works in a way that hardens public opinion against those who are labelled as worthless and undesirable. So public opinion is a very important part of that. But the role the media plays in that, I want you to think a bit about that as well. The stigmatisation, the way that people are held up as unacceptable and how that results in rising inequalities, because the blame, instead of looking at social disadvantage, the finger of blame is pointed against poor people in a pathologising way. So it pathologises individuals rather than looks collectively at the way that we are assigning groups, social groups, to the scrap heap within this way of seeing the world. And of course it's blaming the victims so effectively that everybody turns in hatred against poor people because they see them in these sort of ways. So in Gramscian terms, this is the way the dominant story, the dominant hegemony, is internalised in us all as a form of common sense. And unless we start challenging that, we consent to that happening. And I guess society as a whole, we're all guilty of allowing it to happen. We've allowed it to happen. We haven't challenged it sufficiently. So in these ways, she's suggesting that neoliberal policies continue to govern for the market against the people. Do you see the emphasis I'm putting there? In the name of a free market, it's targeting against people's lives, and that's the hidden part of what's going on. So let me illustrate what I'm talking about. Think about the caricature of the chaff, and think about how class politics has reformulated images of the chaff character, reinforced by people like Matt Lucas. Remember Vicky Pollard? And the part that Matt Lucas has played in people's minds in embedding young women in poverty as feckless, as ignorant, as sexually promiscuous, and turned it into a joke. And these sort of approaches now embed these so much in the mind that I'm told that there are many university parties that are chaff parties. That I think it was Prince Harry went to a chaff party. Do you know? And these ideas take on and they embed these unfortunate attitudes that become a reality in people's lives. Similarly, in the riots of 2011, do you remember when, wasn't Cameron on holiday at the time and he didn't come back for a while, but when he came back, he had a look of Thatcher about him, I felt, tub thumping. These are criminals. Do you remember that? They're gang members. We need to lock them up. And the interesting bit was we need to throw their families out of council housing. What sort of logic is that? But the point I'm trying to make here is to set the juxtaposition here of what's going on with election promises. Because he subscribed to the Child Poverty Act as well. What's going on? And that's what this image here is trying to create. Our young people are revolting at the same time as who's the criminal here? Who's creating the levels of discontent that give rise to that sort of action? I'm not saying that it's a good thing for people to rise up and do things that are unacceptable. I'm saying that what we need to do is ask why it's happening, not react by putting people in prison and not lifting up the lid and asking what's going on. So what I'd like to say is UNICEF challenged the government on a level of criminalisation, a breach of international law on children's rights. That locking up our children is not acceptable. That you cannot criminalise children. At the same time, the Guardian and LSE did a study and found that few of these were gang members. Most of them felt angry and hopeless. And it was triggered by the murder of Mark Duggan, you may remember, and you may have seen that issue in the news, that Mark Duggan, the taxi driver, said was unarmed and running away when a police officer got carried away with himself and shot him as he was running away. So we need to be asking questions under the surface of all this. So just take a moment to imagine what it means to be made abject.
Got 10 minutes.
We're okay, I think.
Yeah.
We're okay. We're on the last section.
So I was introducing social objection theory as a theory of power to make sense of what's going on today, an analysis for our practice. What I'm moving on to here is a stage of action. What can we do about all this? You know, because sometimes it swamps us, doesn't it, and threatens to sink us under the weight of it all. So what I'd like to do is introduce participatory action research as a radical, epistemological challenge to knowledge creation. So here we go. Why can I say that? What leads me to claim that? In other words, it's a completely radical new way of seeing the world. So I'm saying that because in PAR, power in the research process, we aim to equalise it. So instead of a researcher doing something to people who are being studied, the traditional objects of research, those people become the subjects based on a belief that the co-creation of knowledge from lived experience is a valuable truth. In other words, the answers to our theory and our practice lie in the lived experiences, the everyday realities of people in our local communities. In this way, they design and conduct critical inquiry as co-researchers in partnership with us all. Part of this is contesting the collective lies that are based on the interests of privilege. Lies that distort the discriminatory forces at play and present us with such a persuasive dominant ideology that it's internalised. We look at the world in new ways. Sorry, I was going to talk loudly. I do excuse my voice, it's creaking a bit. So every time I go to put a bit of oomph in it, I can feel it cracking up. A new way of seeing the world becomes the basis for creating counter-narratives. This is a dominant narrative telling us how to see the world. PAR's in the business of creating counter-narratives that are full of hope and possibility for a different sort of world, aspirations for a fair and just future. Or through Frantz Fanon in there. Frantz Fanon. You know, part of the neoliberal project is to discourage any form of critique or dissent. People are not allowed to question what's going on. Frantz Fanon, that quote, the society that fails to question itself is a society in which it's not good to be alive. So finally, I wanted to give you a bit of an example of how easy PAR is by taking a quick glance at a group of young black women from the Lower East Side, just a group of six or seven people, who, with a researcher from City University New York called Caitlin, got together to have a look at their neighbourhood, a neighbourhood that they saw as a place of diversity and safety, where they knew everybody, where they were very proud of their neighbourhood, and they saw it as a tolerant place. But when they started asking questions, they started to see the image of a different sort of place. They asked questions that were dear to their experience about what they cared about. Here, this Ruby says, what we knew and what we didn't know. And we learned all about PAR and its potential for opening eyes. And she says, Ruby, I see now with different eyes, with open eyes. And what happened in amongst their inquiry, just one bit of it, they came across a report by an organisation that was working locally about a young black girl called Tanisha. And they'd used a stereotype of this girl, single mother, high school dropout on welfare, little supervision, drops out of high school herself, shoplifts, and by age 16, she's got a police record, pregnant, and got HIV. And they were so outraged about this, they developed a response in their research project to speak back to these sort of stereotypes that reduce them and limit their lives. Reading that report was a turning point for the fed up honeys, as they called themselves. And in the course of getting to understand PAR, they read Paulo Freire and they looked at what he calls the roots of oppression. They started to identify these social and political contradictions of their own daily lives. But they said what was most shocking to them was the way they blamed themselves for it all. And how powerful that was when they realised that these were political forces and that they had taken on board blaming themselves for failing institutions. So just very briefly, in this speaking back, I just really wanted to say at this point, these are some of the questions that they looked at. But the stage of communicating what we find in these local PAR projects is so important for collective action. And they went off to Chicago and talked to a room overflowing with young black people just like them. And they found that they got such a massive response by sharing, communicating that work, that it started to build into an movement for change. And it was based on creating critical spaces to question life, exposing everyday life contradictions, critical consciousness, seeing the world differently, and telling a new story of hope and possibility that leads to the chance for social change. So, here, to justify these claims for PAR as radical. PAR is not a method. It's an approach to research, and it uses many methods. But it's committed to social and environmental justice. It has a value base that frames everything about every stage of its process. So if we talk about respect and dignity and humility and trust, how do we do this in practice? It sets those parameters around which we check out all the time, is what I'm doing contributing to relations that are equal and trusting and so forth. It dismantles power by never working on people, but by working with people in mutual partnerships. It uses methods that liberate and don't control. So if you find yourself doing traditional things like a standard questionnaire, for instance, how does that fit into a liberating method? Do You see, if you question yourself on these, you are controlling who sets the questions, and we have to ask ourselves these things. So we often use story as a way of actually capturing life experience. Everyone becomes a co-researcher in this mutual inquiry. We move towards different ways of knowing the world, and we use different ways of knowing that go beyond the written word. So as well as story, we use dialogue, photos, music, drama. And in these ways, we create, co-create a new sort of knowledge that leads to action for change. So I've gone through a lot of things there, but to end it, I want to end on a note of challenge. I'm suggesting that neoliberalism privileges privilege, that it leads to a politics of disposability, that future well-being is based on how we relate to each other and not on profit, that social justice needs theories of power to see what's going on, and that we need to awaken our sense of injustice and get critical.